Hi, and welcome to the Southern Utah Attainable Housing Real Estate Podcast with Jenny Chamberlain. Today, I'm really excited to introduce a guest from far away Northern Utah. It's my sister, Emily McGill, and she works in lending. So Emily, I'm going to let you introduce yourself a little bit because you know the best about all your professional qualifications.
Okay. I do have to preface this because whenever I talk about mortgages, particularly affordable housing, I will sometimes gleek because I get very excited. So I will try to keep control of myself. I am a principal lending manager. I've been lending since 1997. It was an after-school job when I was in high school. My personal NMLS is 279638. And Cross Country Mortgage, my company, our NMLS is 3029. And we are an equal housing lender. I think that one of the things that I go to with affordable housing in my mind is I think back on the years of me lending and how much it's changed and how it's so relative. There was a meme that I saw online not too long ago where it said, you talk about back in the 80s when you purchased a house for $29,000, but you never talk about, or I have it backwards. You talk about how you purchased a house at 15% back in the 80s, but you don't talk about how it was $29,000. And I think that that is one really strong point that hits home for anybody that is probably over 55 years old. Because they can understand how much the scope of affordable housing has changed. And it's also relative to each individual, kind of the same as how when people will say, I make really good money, I have to lean in and say, what does that mean to you?
Yeah.
Because that can be so different from person to person.
Yeah, I think that's a good point because it has like a lot of the elements in the formula are the same. It's just that the balance between the elements has changed, whereas like pricing and interest rates and incomes, that's always been part of this big complicated picture. But
yeah, I would agree. Well, and it's funny because different regions, even throughout Utah, because I am only licensed to conduct business in Utah right now, even though my company is nationwide. But as I look at different markets throughout the state of Utah, it's funny how I could almost tell you in this market, they're going to try to, for the most part, not have their housing payment be more than 20% of their gross income. Whereas I also know in this other more metropolitan market, they're going to push themselves harder. And on average, they're going to try to have their housing payment be even close to 40% of their gross income, which if you ask the rural markets, they would say that is gross. That's just flat out gross. But I mean, the short answer to debt to income ratio and truly defined affordable housing is budget wise, the experts would say that you want to target your housing expense to be 29 to 33% of your gross income. Mm-hmm. And again, that's all relative. I would say with the current influx of interest rates or the volatility that we've experienced throughout 2022, the landscape of lending has changed a lot. You know, when COVID hit, rates tanked and it became this mad refi boom. People were desperate to be able to purchase. Rates were great, but you couldn't get a house. Now there's all these houses on the market and a lot of people are really afraid to pull the trigger. And so I really love that we're talking about this right now because there are some really great solutions. One that's been the most popular has been buy-downs, temporary buy-downs. Mm-hmm. And you see a lot of it on social media within the real estate industry. But in short, the way that it works is either the seller or builder or lender, not the buyer, but one of those other parties has to contribute towards the closing costs and it can buy the interest rate down lower. Mm-hmm. So hypothetically, if the life of loan interest rate were going to be 6% over the general life of the loan, and they did say a 2-1 buy down, then the first year of their loan, their rate would be 4%, the next year would be 5%, and then it would graduate to 6%. And so it kind of eases their way into affordability, and that rate is bought down by those other parties to hence create affordable housing.
So if a builder I'm a little less familiar with this. So if a builder or a whoever buys down someone's rate, is that putting them in an adjustable rate mortgage if the rate's going to go up every year for 3 years? Is that the same, or is it different from an ARM?
It's not an adjustable rate in the sense of a traditional adjustable rate, because somewhat of an adjustable rate is the unpredictable feature, which is why I always say that ARMs are a four-letter word. I'm not a big fan of ARMs. Anybody that knows me in the industry knows I don't love ARMs unless it's a very sophisticated borrower. The buy-down is more protected as far as the consumer's interest, because they know what it's going to be. They're going into the loan knowing what it's going to be, which I'm a big fan of, versus the reason that I don't like ARMs is I don't want somebody to get into an ARM on a loan that I closed with them, and in 5 years, they're shaking their arm in the air thinking, you know, dang you, Emily, why did you put me in this loan? Yeah. That's heartbreaking for me to imagine. And so, I mean, I have had some wealthy, very savvy borrowers almost have to beg me to put them in an ARM, and I quiz them and I just make sure they really understand what they're doing, because it can be very risky for a consumer not knowing what their payment's going to be. So that's what I would say is the big difference.
Okay. So the ARM is tied to the market rates, but the buy down, while there is a little bit of changing, it's going to be a fixed rate eventually. Is that what you're saying?
It's always a fixed rate, but it's presented up front that your rate is going to begin at this lower bought down interest rate. And then on the anniversary of your 1 year, it's going to graduate 1% higher. And then on the next year, it's going to graduate 1% higher. And then, which that's the 2-1 buy down. And that's the most common buy down. And then that one is going to stay your rate for the remainder of the note.
Okay. And with the buy down, do they still get an advantage over the life of the loan? Like, is the overall rate still, I mean, it's lower from that first year or two, but are they still getting like the market rate of interest?
So when they close, their long-term rate is current market.
Okay.
But so if the going rate is 6%, their rate is basically 6%. But then the buy down feature creates the opportunity where they start off with a 2% lower rate for the first year, 1% lower. So in the example of 6%, the first year the rate is 4%, the second year it's 5%, and then it graduates to 6% for the remainder of the loan. And there are also 3-1 buy downs. And I just recently was reading about a 4-1 buy down that one investor has rolled out. I don't think that those are as popular because of the fees that come behind it. Because obviously, the more that you're going to be, the more years you're going to be buying down the interest rate, it gets kind of expensive.
Yeah.
Another angle to create an affordable loan that's kind of interesting is a 40-year amortization, which can be done as a 40-year fixed, or you can also do a 40-year fixed that would balloon in 30 years and has a interest-only feature as well. So there's a lot of different ways that you could do it. A 40-year could be just 40-year fixed. It could be a 40-year fixed, but balloons in 30 years, which a balloon is where the current amortization loan balance becomes due in full. But
they probably want to like refinance or sell at that point.
Yeah.
Like they're just doing long-term planning when they make this decision.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I think that it's kind of just biting the bullet in this current market, because you can do a 40-year amortization with a 10-year interest-only feature in the first 10 years. And really, the reason that I like that is that it, even though it's interest-only, the consumer knows what their payment is, which again is why I don't like ARM mortgages. I'm not a super fan of ARM mortgages. But in 10 years, that buys them the time for either the market to shift or them to experience a life-changing event where they need to either upgrade their property or, you know,
or make get a smaller one, or
downsize.
Or their income might increase. Yeah.
Downsize, yeah. Or they'll win the lottery. I mean, if you ask my husband, that's his 5-year plan, so.
Good luck with that. Good luck with that. I just have a question from something you mentioned earlier. You mentioned rate volatility, and I feel like I keep hearing lenders talk about this. Can you kind of just explain to somebody who's like as if we were a beginner and didn't know what was going on this last year.
Yes, yes. It's very close to my heart because this last year has really hurt my feelings. The last loan that I closed in 2021, I believe it was on December 30th, and I remember the rate on that loan was at 2.625. Mm-hmm. And the borrower had asked me that day, he said, by chance, if I wasn't locked in at this rate, what would my rate be? And I said, you definitely would be in the threes. And he said, oh, good, I'm going to close. And really, pretty quickly, we were in the threes across the board on all loans coming into 2022. I remember I was still able to attain rates in the threes up till March. Mm-hmm. And I just remember the market continually getting more and more volatile and more emotional, because people that were pre-qualified, we were constantly having to review our files and call people and say, hey, you're not really great pre-qual that we gave you. You no longer qualify for that because, great news, rates went up 1%. So your pre-quals dropped 50,000.
Ooh, you so know? That changes. That's hard because they may have already been out shopping for homes in a certain price range. And to say that yanks probably all the top, their top choices right out of there.
Yeah. And they were probably already having a hard time finding a house. And mm-hmm. then we're calling them to say,
by the
way, we have some more bad news.
I feel bad laughing at that. That's very somber.
It is very somber, but I do think that a healthy sense of humor through this craziness is important.
That's to true.
Either keep your sanity or maybe I'm off kilter. I'm not sure. But I feel like having a good sense of humor right now is very important just because it feels so insane what is happening. I mean, this year, there's been unprecedented changes in the last 3 years, but this year in particular, you know, I'll be 41 next week. And I was watching one of the East Coast economic reports the other day, and they were talking about how many things have happened that have not occurred in our economy in 40 years. And I thought, wow, I was in diapers. So mm-hmm. I better be paying attention and, mm-hmm. you know, keep my sense of humor intact. But for a minute, their rates were in the high sevens. This last week, we experienced the highest decline in 1 week mm-hmm. that we had experienced in 40 years.
Mm-hmm. And you were practicing lending in the last kind of big tumultuous market in like 07 and 08, right? How would you say that this year has compared to that time?
Oh, so different. I mean, even the recession is different for a few reasons. Namely, the most obvious is the job market is vastly different. Mm-hmm. One interesting twist on that is all the baby boomers that retired through COVID.
Yeah.
Because they're such a big part of our consumer pool, but they were also a big part of our workforce.
Yeah.
And then you've also got a lot of young people that are more focused on education or their mental health versus, I feel like my generation was more, we've got to get out, we got to make money, we got to work hard, mm-hmm. you know, we'll deal with our feelings later, which is probably why, all of our children care so much about feelings. But I mean, even just the changes that were happening, I remember in 2007, so many of my friends calling me and saying, I'm dying, I'm not getting any business, everything is falling apart. And I didn't really know what they were talking about. I felt
like industry friends, you mean?
Yeah, mm-hmm. industry friends, past colleagues. Mm-hmm. And I felt like the industry was still very robust. Mm-hmm. And we were very busy. I was managing a number of states, a number of loan officers in a retail channel of a lending company that one day, it was the third week of October of 2007, the vice president came into our company offices and he looked very stressed out. He came stomping into my office and he said, the CEO needs to talk to you immediately. And I looked at him and smiled over several stacks of over a foot tall of files that I had to fix for loan officers. Mm-hmm. And I said, is there any way we could do this later? I am very, very busy. And I just kept working because I felt like that was where my priorities lied. I've got work to do. I can't be mm-hmm. chit-chatting. And he came in a couple more times and he finally stomped in and he said, we have had a margin call that we're not going to be able to facilitate. we're closing in 90 minutes. Get down to the CEO's office. And I just froze. It was unbelievable to me to have all of these loans and find out that we didn't have a way to fund them.
Wow.
Yeah, because, I mean, I won't go into the specific numbers, but there was a substantial deficiency in making the margin call to where, I mean, by that afternoon, I was unemployed. I went into work thinking how slammed I was, and I left without a job.
Wow.
And
this year's been different.
This year's been different. I mean, the scope of business that I do is broad. I mean, my team does high-profile relocations for high-wage earners all the way down to, I could be doing a rural located single-wide manufactured home for $64,000 alongside with, you know, a doctor loan. Mm-hmm. And so I really pride myself in taking care of all of those different, I guess you could say different.
Any client.
Any
financial situation.
Any financial situation. That's a perfect way to describe it. Mm-hmm. But I've noticed that the clientele has really changed to where the middle class, I feel like, has dropped out a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing the wealthy continue to move forward. They're kind of less impacted, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
Some might say in some cases they're more educated to where they've already made a plan because they're very financially savvy from being in investing for a long period of time. But then the other interesting thing is a lot of the low wage earners that have been trying to buy for a long time are really stepping up to the plate and saying, I'm going to do this. I really want to buy a house and I'm willing to go the extra mile to be able to do so. I mean, there still are middle class buyers, but I would say that they are the most hesitant in my experience.
Mm-hmm. Right now, tumultuous time.
Okay. I mean, we do a lot of manufactured housing on my team. And I would say that that is something that people probably should gravitate towards.
Mm-hmm.
Because you could build a manufactured home quickly and easily, and the pricing is really very, very minorly different from a site-built home.
Mm-hmm.
And the quality has changed vastly. I mean, they're beautiful homes. And you can get 100% financing if you buy an existing one. If you want to build one, you definitely have to have some down, but the affordability is, in my mind, very attainable.
So here's the question about that. In a lot of my studies, I've found that zoning is one of the biggest influences on attainability. And, you know, some of the reports that I've read have said that city zoning is a huge factor. And in the cities that I have worked in, I see a lot of resistance to having new subdivisions that are free and open like that, where you can just put a modular home on. Do you see that in your industry? Is it more of a rural thing to be able to get a modular home? And if someone's in a city, are they going to be able to find something like that?
The short answer is I would say that it's primarily based off of education and necessity.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are a lot of false preconceived notions with manufactured housing. And to some extent, I do understand it. It's just people need to educate themselves. So really the core reason behind that is there used to be no regulation to manufactured housing.
Mm-hmm.
Very literally, there are manufactured homes out there that have cardboard walls and duct tape seams because manufacturers didn't have any regulations until mm-hmm. HUD, Housing and Urban Development, came out and said, wait a minute, we need to regulate this. And so they put parameters in place that are federally overseen by HUD.
Mm-hmm.
And they went into effect June 15th of 1976. And so from that date moving forward, June 15th of 1976, they began putting those HUD plates on mm-hmm. the homes. And that means that they are built to the federal code. Whereas a lot of people think manufactured and modular are the same, and they are actually not.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is a modular home is built custom to be to the local standards of where it's going to be placed geographically.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the big difference. And that's why the cost is different, is because mm-hmm. there is some more customizations. Typically the walls are thicker. the foundation is modular? Differently.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, I mean, I just think that people need to educate themselves because mm-hmm. for a regulator that is saying that they just don't want manufactured homes in their community because they think it's riffraff or they're, I hate the term quote unquote trailer trash. I hate that because there are very educated, sophisticated, kind, wonderful, amazing people that buy manufactured homes every day. Mm-hmm. And it creates an amazing outlet of affordable housing for wonderful people throughout many communities.
Yeah.
So I would say that education is big and then necessity. I think that people need to, decision makers, regulators need to first gain an education and then recognize the necessity behind it. Mm-hmm. And I think that could bridge a lot of gaps within affordable housing.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's that issue is one that's like, it's one of those situations where it's not just a simple, oh, if we just educate the regulators, it'll solve it. Because there's also market forces at work where a lot of builders don't want to build something that's affordable because they can build something that's more expensive and their margin of profit is a lot higher. And while the market has been so wild and free and easy to sell those expensive homes, I think it's been good. And I think that the tightening in the current market is going to help some of the focus shift from those high-end homes. I hope it will, but
I really hope that it will too. I mean, I've had some really heartfelt conversations with homeowners that just feel like the housing market is not for them. And I think one thing that is the most tragic from the pandemic is how many deep-pocketed housing conglomerates went about the market paying cash for so many houses and pricing every day first-time home buyers or the quote-unquote average American Joe mm-hmm. that wants to accomplish the American dream, making it less possible for them. Mm-hmm. It's really a heartbreaker for me. In fact, we sold our last home, my husband and I, in the summer of 2021, and our highest offer was from an investor. Mm. And my husband and I kind of had some words because he said, highest and best. And I said, well, it is the highest, but it's not the best. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, we did get a decent offer from first-time home buyers, and I have no regrets. And I wish that more people saw the value behind that.
Yeah.
We've all, to some extent, been in those shoes, mm-hmm. whether it's a house or getting your kids into a school, your car breaking down and you can't fix it and you're in college. I mean, we all know that feeling behind it. And I think that if we as American consumers could pull together and try to take a stand of some values, core values, mm-hmm. of where we will only sell to somebody that's going to be owner-occupied.
And an owner, yeah.
If we can. I mean, obviously I have clients that are investors. It's not like investors are these evil villains or anything like that. I'm just saying that there does need to be some kind of precedent for owner occupancy. It's why the government had added, it's called LLPA, it's loan level price adjustments to investment properties, mm-hmm. was because they wanted to try to slow the roll on investment properties selling. And I've explained it to investors when they say, why is it so expensive to buy an investment property? Well, it's because there's a lot of people that can't even buy one house.
Yeah.
I think that another way to create affordability too, that kind of ties into the manufactured housing, would be a construction loan. Because mm-hmm. to my point, when I sold our house in the summer of 2021, we had decided to build right as the pandemic started. Mm-hmm. I saw construction futures going through the roof, rates dropping, and I turned to my husband and I said, if we're going to build, we have to do it now. Mm-hmm. And so we did. And it's one of the best things that we did. And I think just really reviewing and analyzing the numbers of those scenarios closely throughout 2020 and 2021, I started looking back historically. And really, anytime that you do it, it's a good move. Because
anytime that you build?
Anytime that you build.
Okay.
Because you're typically shaving off some margins in building because mm-hmm. you're kind of going direct to the source, if you will. And I mean, I'm not saying don't use a builder. You absolutely should use a builder because you need an expert by your side. Mm-hmm. But I'm just saying that you are shaving off some costs because there's less involved mm-hmm. and you're able to build your dream.
Yeah. I like owners working with builders directly if you can. I think that works really well because when you have a developer added, they always are watching for their own margin rather than for the client. I've heard a builder from the Southern Utah Home Builders Association. He has talked a lot about how one of the best ways for us to create affordable housing is for us to build plenty of new home stock because affordable housing is typically stuff that's 20 years old. Because that's the point at which, you know, in real estate school, they tell you that the shelf life of a house is 12 years. Like if you buy a new home, that's when everything starts to go wrong. You have to get a new air conditioner or replace serious stuff that starts to get expensive. And that's the kind of thing that people who are equipped to afford a new home, they can pay that extra cost up front because new building is a little bit more expensive. And I think part of the trouble that we've been running into right now is because in 07, 08, a lot of builders got burned. Like they had a similar situation to you where they were building, busy, and then all of a sudden the phone just stopped ringing and they didn't have anything to build for several years. And so we've been building under demand for quite a while, least in Utah, and especially in Southern Utah, because construction is one of our bigger industries in the whole county.
So. Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, I remember during the recession in 08 and 09, I remember driving through developments of houses that were built up about 70, 80 or 90%. And then the builder had foreclosed because they had been living partially off of that construction loan and everything, you know, the mm-hmm. cards, you know, couldn't stack in the end and it all folded. Mm-hmm. And so to speak, and it was really depressing. I mean, kind of the energy that you would feel when you would walk through these houses, it would just make you sick because you knew that there was a builder behind it that initially was well-intended and there was a homeowner that was their dream and that both basically fell apart for them.
Yeah. I had a friend who, funny enough, because she worked in title, and so that kind of gave her an insider information advantage. So when everything was short selling, she went and found a home that everybody who made offers with regular pre-approval, but she got pre-approved for a construction loan because that would help her finish building. Because it was like that. It was just to the point where a normal lender probably wouldn't lend on it because it wasn't complete. And the seller was a bank, and so they knew that. So when she came pre-approved with her construction loan, she was the one who got it, and she got it for a good deal because of it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That is awesome. Yeah. There is something to be said about having an education behind housing. Mm-hmm. I just told one of my clients yesterday, she kept apologizing and saying, I'm so sorry. I know nothing about housing. I know nothing about mortgages. This is so scary. And I said, well, the great news is I love that that's where you're at because I get to help you. And if you knew everything, I'd be out of a job. So,
yeah.
You know, let me help you help yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, have you got any other things you really want to talk about obtainable housing before we wrap it up?
I think that a couple of points that I would probably like to make, if somebody is listening and they or someone in their family is a first-time home buyer or wants to purchase, there are really great down payment assistance options out there. And my company is offering a rebate where if you buy a home right now, you can refinance it in the next 3 years and get a $3,000 credit towards your next loan. And it's a genuine credit. And I think that glimmer of hope helps people a lot. There's a Fannie Mae report that came out the end of August that stated that they believe that interest rates will be in the fours by the end of next year, which is the inspiration behind our rebate. Mm-hmm. And so that we could say, you know what? Everybody's saying date the rate, buy the house, or buy the house, date the rate. So this is a great way for people to do that. They could get their foot in the door mm-hmm. and then we will give them a rebate later to improve their loan terms. Mm-hmm. And I just want people to remember that. And then also, if you're not wanting to do any kind of a government endorsed loan, there's even conventional loans where you can get down payment assistance or have as little as 3% down. So there's really terrific options. 100% financing is really attainable with a 620 credit score in the state of Utah mm-hmm. under the bond programs. And I think that that surprises a lot of people. And so just getting that fact out hopefully will help someone.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. It's good to see you.
The pleasure is all mine.
Thank you for listening to the Southern Utah Real Estate Podcast with Jenny Chamberlain. I hope you'll think about subscribing and give the podcast a review if you found it valuable. If you have feedback or ideas to make this podcast better, check out my website, jennychamberlain.com, and leave me a message there.